When you say the book of Revelation, people go, they get the willies. I don't know why. The Bible promises a blessing for anyone who reads it, and especially anyone who takes it to heart. Don't be afraid of the book of Revelation. We're going to have fun traipsing back and forth through the 66 books of the Old and New Testament. We're going to see starting today that there is no way humans could have engineered these. Remember, the context is the 70th week of Daniel. 70 weeks of years, 70 seven-year periods that God promised that would happen with the nation of Israel. 69 of those weeks or seven-year periods or 483 years or 173,880 days. Palm Sunday, April 6, 32 AD. The book of Revelation, chapter 1, verse 19, comes with its own outline. Here's how it's going to go down. Write the things which you have seen. That's going to be Revelation chapter 1. Write the things which are currently. That's going to be chapters 2 and 3, the seven letters to the seven churches. And then starting in chapters 5 and following, and the things which will take place after this. After what? After the seven churches. First slide. These are the seven churches in the book of Revelation in chapters 2 and 3. Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. I want you to notice something. Sevens, of course, are big in the blueprint of the engineering of the Scriptures. Why? Because seven is God's number of completion. How many days in the week? How many continents on the planet? How many oceans or seas on the planet? Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, seven, and then do is the octave. How many visible colors in the rainbow? Seven. What's going on with the sevens? Because the engineer is at work. Seven letters to the seven churches. Now, there were more churches, obviously, in the New Testament times. In Matthew 13, the kingdom of heaven is like, how many parables? Do you remember? Go button. The sower, the wheat and the tares, the mustard seed, the three lumps of leaven, the treasure hidden in a field, the pearl of great price, and then the dragnet. Did you know that there are seven letters to seven churches in the New Testament? You've got your epistles, which are 1st and 2nd Timothy, Philemon. But if you count up Romans and Corinthians, guess how many cities, guess how many letters go out? Go ahead. There they are, Romans, Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and Thessalonians. I want you to notice that the letter to the church in Ephesus in the book of Revelation, then cruise over to Matthew 13, check out the parable of the sower. Then cruise over to the book of Romans. You will see some similarities. The seven letters to the seven churches in the book of Revelation are to seven actual churches that really did exist. But now that we've had 2,000 years of hindsight, historians have noticed something, that the characteristics talked about in the book of Ephesus, the parable of the sower, and the teachings, the Christian manifesto, really, of the book of Romans, also seem to coincide with a period of church history. Hit the go button. Look at the accounts of the book of Acts until about 100 AD. You're going to see some similarities. The church of Smyrna was a real church, but it also is sort of indicative of a church age of history. The teachings and the encouragements and the corrections of our Lord to Smyrna, as well as the wheat and the tares, and even the books of 1st and 2nd Corinthians, seem to be indicative of the church from about 100 AD to about 113 AD. Pergamos is indicative of the church period from 300. That's when Constantine takes over. And remember, Constantine needs some help to overthrow his rival, Maxinius, for the emperorship of Rome. So he enlisted the Christians. For the first 300 years, what were the Romans doing to most of the Christians? Killing them. It was Constantine who said, I need those Christians. He tells the leadership of the church there in Rome, he said, I had a vision. I have seen the light. And he literally says, I looked in the sun, I saw a shield with your cross on it, and then I heard the audible words of the Lord Almighty saying, in this sign, go and conquer, conquer, conquer. So he does. He defeats his rival, becomes the emperor of Rome, and in his gratitude, he reaches out to the Christian church and says, you guys ought to come in now. Within a few years, the Christians went from the rags of hiding in the catacombs to the silks of court as Constantine gave jobs to the Christians. And how many of you know it's good to work for the government? Then a few emperors later, then Rome adopts that Christianity will be the Roman religion. The world marries the church. Gamos means marriage. Monogamy means married to one person. Polygamy means married to more than one person. And Lord knows why anybody would want to do that. But pergamos is marriage with the world. That's what happened to the church about 313 AD all the way up to 590. Then Thyatira, we're going to see what happens and how the church gets wonky, 590 to 511. And then you get to Sardis. Some people love to go through Thyatira because they say, let's go get them Catholics. Protestants, you're going to get yours in the church of Sardis because we had our issues too. That's to the Reformation. Then the Philadelphia, that's the church 1700 to probably even present. The pearl of great price is found in the field. The field is always a picture of the world. What was the Lord doing? He was looking through the world, trying to find one pearl of great price. Then he sold everything he had to purchase it. That is a picture of the church in its ministry form, its missionary form. And from the 1700s to probably even recently, the greatest missionaries went out through all the world. And then finally, the Laodicean church. Also coincides with the dragnet, also coincides with 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. What are they talking about? The Antichrist in the last days and the rapture. And it says, be careful, because in the last days, there's going to be mega churches. Huge churches with money, 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 money. And people are going to come in and they're going to hear exceptional music and wonderfully uplifting teachings on you can do it. Your finances, your marriage, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know. Come on, you can do it, friends. And there will be thousands and thousands and thousands of precious men and women of God, sons and daughters of God, in my personal opinion, who are going to get inoculated against giving their lives to the Lord. What are you talking about? There are going to be people that are going to go to church every single Sunday and never hear the gospel. And I better say right now while we're here, how many of us are sinners? How many of you are not sinners? Liars. How many have sinned, everybody? All of us. Like Billy Graham used to say, you know, you're not a sinner because you sin. You sin because you and I are sinners. You can't stop, you see. My good works outweigh my bad works. Well, then I'm in. No. God says, for me to have fellowship with you, you have to be like I am, righteous. What does that mean? Pure. I've illustrated it before. You have a pitcher of pure distilled water, nothing but H2O. In my other pitcher, I have pond water, and it's got little green wiggly things growing in it. I don't know what they are. I've got pond water, I've got pure water. They are two natures of water. How much pond water can I introduce into my pure water before the pure water changes its nature? God is like the pure water, and God wants to hang and talk and have relationship with His kids. But we are like pond water because we've been sinning since we were kids. And we're really good at it. How are the two going to get together? That's what God did on the cross. He zipped up a human suit. He lived a perfect life, never sinned. And then He went to the cross and He said, all of God's anger about all that sin has caused. Every one of us has difficult stories to tell. If the statistics are true in this room, there's violence been done to some. Sexual assault has been done to some. Terrible emotional damage have been done to many. Ain't none of us escaped childhood unscathed. And God says, I know that. And I was there when all those horrible things were happening to you. God, you ought to do something about that. I did. I zipped up a human suit. And I took all of my righteous anger about all that was done against you. And I poured it out upon myself. In a legal term, what he did was, he took down my ledger, all my sin off the shelf. There's Steve Hadley right there. Oh, one page after the, ooh, I, woo, that boy's bad. You may not think I'm such a bad person, but you don't know what's going on in here a lot of the time, or sometimes in here. And Jesus says, I know every single sin that was ever committed and ever will be committed, because He's God, He's outside of time. And He hung on the cross, and then Paul said, He took the writ that was written against me. He took my ledger with all my sin. How much of my sin? How much of your sin? And He put it on the cross. He nailed it to the cross. You've probably heard this. How could a loving God send anybody to hell? You don't understand the correct theology here. You don't go to hell because of your sin. Now follow me in this. How much sin did Jesus pay for? You don't go to hell because of your sin. You go to hell because you refused His every effort to keep you out. It's been said you've got to literally shove aside Jesus' dead body to earn your own way into hell. Somebody is saved because they said, Jesus, I need that free gift of salvation. Then it is yours, and He never takes it back. All the bad guys, Hitler, Stalin, who was responsible for 20 million deaths. You mean his too? Answer, yeah. If Stalin is in hell, it's not because of the 20 million deaths. It's because he went to the grave refusing to receive Jesus' payment, full payment of his sins. Jesus doesn't send anybody to hell. You shove Him aside time and time and time again to get there. Laodicea Church. Jesus prophesied, He said that in the end times there is going to be a significant number of very large, dynamic, attractive churches. They smell similar to the culture out there. Come to our church because we've got goodies for you. It may burst some bubbles in here, but church really isn't for us. It's for Him. Church is not a place designed by the Lord for nice people get nicer. It's a place where dead people come and learn how to live. The seven churches are real churches that really existed. They also represent seven heart conditions that individual people can have. 19 centuries of church history behind us. Well, look at that. The descriptions of Ephesus, Smyrna, et al., are also indicative of these seven epochs of time that the church itself will be holding to. Why 7 years? Well, because it's the 70th week of Daniel. Matthew chapter 25, Jesus talked about there's going to be 10 virgins that are waiting for the bridegroom to come. Five of the virgins had oil in their lamps and five didn't. When the groomsmen came, and the five who didn't have the lamp had to run to Kmart to get some. And then they missed it. When a Jewish woman agreed to a marriage proposal, The gifts and the dowry were then received by the two agreeing parents, and payment was made. The cross. Then there would be a cup of the covenant to signify. Instead of signing on a line, they would hoist a cup. The father of the groom would return to his house and construct a room for them to live in. And Jesus, right before he departed, he said, I go to prepare a place for you. Who was the you, everybody? It was us. It was the bride. Then the father would decide when the room was ready. And the son did not know. A father would say, need a little more spackle on that one, son. Need a little more room over here, son. The bride would be getting steady reports about how the room was shaping up. She would watch for signs of the time. As the time grew near, she would gather her bridesmaids and ready themselves with oil in their lamps, because sometimes the groom liked to kind of mix things up and come even at midnight. Then they would sound trumpets, and the groomsmen would shout, it's time! It's time! Go get the bride! And the bridesmaid would trim their lamps, go out into the street, and meet the coming processional halfway. Jesus said, when I blow the trumpet, you guys are going to rise up, and we are going to meet the Lord where? Infernally. We're going to meet the Lord where, you guys? In the air, halfway. Then at that point, the bride, the whole processional, the bride and groom were covered with a canopy, was placed over them, and the wedding vows were said right there. The groom would take the bride back to his father's house. The groom and the bride would stay sequestered, alone, in a room prepared for them for 1 week. Honeymoon, no work, didn't have to take care of any bills. The family took care of everything. Friends brought food and ho-hos. It was awesome. And at the end of the week, the groom comes out and presents his bride to everybody. When we come back with Jesus Christ in Revelation 19, that is a picture of this incident right here. See my bride, says the Lord, as we head to earth. Wow. And all those who are in attendance sit down to a magnificent banquet. What's the purpose of the tribulation? For God to be really mad? Uh-uh. To take up the bride. Number two, to shake up the heathen. To wake up the nation of Israel. Daniel 3, you remember? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego go into the fiery furnace. Who throws them there? Nebuchadnezzar, who's a model of the Antichrist. What's the furnace a model of? It's a model of the seven-year tribulation. Do they finally see the Son of Man? Yes. Where? On the outside? In the midst of the fiery furnace. They go, ding, oh, you are our Messiah. And then finally, to make up the kingdom. As I said, Matthew 25, sheep and the goats. God is going to clean up a ravaged earth, and those who repopulate the planet are going to be all believers, and they too will have a chance to choose Jesus as well. Are you ready? Revelation chapter 1, verse 1. I got to tell you a little bit about John, though. I don't think we're going to get very far. Are you all right with that? Who was John? Do you remember him? James and John. They were brothers. They were born at a place called Bethsaida to Zebedee and Salome. They were the sons of Zebedee. And he was a Galilean fisherman. I've been to Galilee. It's a beautiful place. It was a great way to make a living. And he was a partner with Peter and Andrew in this fishing business. He was an early disciple of John the Baptist, remember. The Gospel of John tells us that. Until John the Baptist encountered Jesus. And then John the Baptist said, you got to follow him now. And I must decrease and he must increase. He was well connected, was John, with the high priest. In the Gospel of John, we get a lot of the insight of what was going on at Jesus' trial, because John had a connection at the front gate who let him in. And he was also part of the inner circle, Peter, James, and John. You see that at the Mount of Transfiguration, Matthew 17, the rising of Jairus' daughter, the Olivet Discourse, Gethsemane. He's assigned the care of Jesus' mom. It is only John who is at the foot of the cross that day when Jesus is killed. And ultimately, he's going to be retiring to Ephesus, the largest church of the New Testament era. But we're going to see him now in the book of Revelation. He has been some 10 years exiled to this little rock out in the Aegean Sea off the Greek coast. About 24 to 26 miles. And it is a rock. If you go there today, it's actually kind of nice. They have gardens there, nice places to kind of hang out, and they've got some good restaurants. But that's only because of the pilgrimage of people who want to go to the supposed cave where John wrote the book of Revelation. In John's day, a rock, hardly anything, wasn't even able to subsist on its own produce. It had to be shipped in, by and large. You know how Australia was the penal colony of the British Empire? Patmos was one of the places where they shipped their most dangerous exiles. Why was John dangerous? He was dangerous because they tried to martyr him. They threw him in a cauldron of boiling oil. Only, he wasn't a French fry. He didn't die. And then he climbed out and they're all, dang. So what are you going to do with a guy that you can't kill like that? You're going to have to ship him off 24 to 26 miles offshore. This island is only 6 miles by 10 miles. John was exiled by the terrible emperor Domitian. Domitian was the brother of Titus. Titus was the guy who had destroyed Jerusalem. And according to Irenaeus, one of our early church fathers, about the 2nd century A.D., Revelation was written by John during this reign while he was on Patmos, and that's in fact what he says. Domitian dies about 96 A.D. So by the time he gets out of his exile, John is going to be almost 100 years old. Can you imagine being in your 80s and sleeping on a rock? By the time John dies at the age of 100, he was released from Patmos. He goes and hangs out at the church of Ephesus that's being pastored by Timothy, that you read about in 1 and 2 Timothy. By the time that John dies, the 27 books of the New Testament were settled. Some people who come to your door who claim to be Bible experts or scholars, they'll try to tell you, no, it was the Council of Nicaea in 320-something A.D. that decided the 27 books of the New Testament. Not so. Why is that important? Every once in a while, you'll see on the Discovery Channel, somebody said, we found another gospel. It's the gospel according to Lazarus. It's the gospel according to Judas. Who do you think wins in the gospel of Judas? The Discovery Channel piquing your interest. Have you heard about the lost books of the New Testament? Well, they're not lost. They're not in the New Testament. Why? Because you could bring those to John. He'd look them over. Nope. Out it goes.